episode of Smoke Signals. I'm Venture, and we have a great episode for you guys today. Go ahead and tell the listener, you know, your name and where you're coming from.
All right. My name is Michael Running Wind. I'm out of Fresno, California, raised partially in Nevada, and then kind of just grew up here in California. How I was told we do this in our traditional ways, we usually speak our language. You say, you know, we say Yahweh Skano, and it doesn't mean like hello or greetings. It's used as that, but it actually means it's good to see that you're alive, and that like the Creator has put breath in you. You know, so it's like it's a very good thing that like you're living. So we're acknowledging you as life, and we're seeing the response. So we're receiving that same life when we're saying, when we're giving our greeting to each other. And then we go and we go into our clans, which are our maternal clans, and we say like Agatha Yoni means I'm from the wolf clan. And then we say Onondaga Tsotsi. Onondaga is people of the longhouse. Tsotsi means people of the big mountain. And then when we're acknowledging ourselves and where we're from, we'll usually say, just so people can kind of understand us, not everybody speaks our language or close to understanding each other's languages. So, you know, we'll say like Six Nations, Ontario, Canada, and Noongar. So we're saying that part in English, and then we're saying the next part in our language, so we can converse with those that don't speak the language. And there's a lot of languages that are related to each other, if you didn't know that. So it's a wonderful thing to be able to me, how I was taught is it's a wonderful thing to be able to understand. I don't know my language fluently, but I'm still learning. And they say that when you know your language or you start learning your language, you connect to your ancestors the way that they spoke their language and the way they understood things during their time. And so now that gives you a living, breathing version of you sitting with your ancestors right here in the present. So it's a wonderful thing, you know, these cultural understandings, and it just starts with us talking. You know, that's it. Just we're just talking, and then I'm explaining to you, you know, in my language, hey, this is what this means. You know, this is how deep it is. You know, really, our language should really be considered sacred in that matter.
I love that. I love that. Well, taking it back for a second, did you say you're in Fresno currently, correct?
Yeah, I'm currently in Fresno right now.
How's the weather out there right now?
Over here, it's about a nice baking 89 degrees. It's cooling down.
Okay, that's nice. And I haven't made it up to Fresno yet. Not too much connection. I know people who are from Fresno. I've never had the opportunity to go out there, so it's pretty cool. What brought you out to Fresno?
Well, like I said, I was born here. I was born here, even on the same side that I'm at. This is called the east side of Fresno, where I'm at. And I was born literally like four blocks from here, called Valley Medical Hospital.
Yeah.
And they shut down that whole hospital. Now it's called University Medical Center. So they actually have a live-in university where people come to learn about every aspect of, you know, medicine here. So Fresno has actually grown a lot.
Yeah, I've heard. And what is it, obviously, I guess, give the quick breakdown for the people, what it is that you do day to day, you know, career-wise, you know, family-wise, things like that.
No, I'm currently, I consider myself retired, but self-employed. I served in the United States Marine Corps roughly about 8 years, 4 years on standby. That was me from the age of 19 all the way until about maybe 26, 28, somewhere around there. Got out in 2006. I'm currently 46 years old right now. After I got out, I just did, you know, what everybody else does. I was just trying to reintegrate, going from where I was. It was peacetime, and we did jungle training. And then from that, we went to extreme high desert training to go out into Iraq and Afghanistan. And then after combat tour was done, I got back, and it was time for me to, my contract was done. So I was kind of in shock because I was so programmed on what to do. I tried to just reintegrate right away with no formal training on how to do that. Slow down when you eat. Don't just punch people in the face just to punch them in the face because you're mad, because that's okay in the Marine Corps, not out here, those kinds of things. And I did jobs here and there, and I just over time kind of found my niche. I did a paraprofessional teaching, TA, did a lot of instruction, motivational speaking. And up to now, I'm currently opening up a 501c for cultural bearers, Native American based, and I want to kind of give out scholarships to needy young people, people from various indigenous backgrounds. But it's hard to make it going to school. I went back to school at 36, and it was pretty tough. Even though I had the Montgomery GI Bill from the military to back me up, I still paid $90,000 a year, and I still had to make ends just to, get my degree, and be able to still pay my bills and every day kind of living type of things. And so that's my kind of vision right now. And I do some small craft sales here and there. You saw me over at UNLV. We had a booth over there, and I make a lot of jewelry. I make ties and bags and belts and things like that. And that sustains me. It's extra money. And then like I said, I'm currently retired. I got a little bit some disabilities here from the military. Just a lot of wear and tear from carry 480 pound back on your pack on your back for 365 days. Marching as fast as 4 miles an hour, going up to about 300 and even up to 1,000 miles on foot. Yeah, you're gonna get some wear and tear. So, the VA sends me some compensation for my service. So, I'm good with that. It's a wonderful thing. So I'm in between things. I work part time just for myself, and my vision is this new 501c3, and just if I get the chance to travel, I travel. Just like I saw you over at UNLV. We were supposed to go to Flagstaff, but what happened? That storm went through there and it closed down the freeway, and we couldn't get in. So we didn't have 4x4 chains, so we had to turn back around.
Yeah, I
So
got you. And they'll stop you over there. Good thing they'll do that,
yeah,
right? Because
not too
idiots will just
safe.
pull through,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. So we went back to
Well,
Vegas and just cruised it, just played tourists and checked out some shows, and went to see the sights, the living statues of Caesar's Palace. It was pretty cool.
it's always fun to do that. It's needed too. Like sometimes, and piggyback off this if needed. Sometimes the best memories that I've found myself making, either with my family or with my friends, is when you go off the beaten path, right? When the things aren't predicted and you think that you're going to do a trip to Hawaii, let's say, and then all of a sudden the biggest hurricane in 10 years comes away and you guys all have to go to the other side of the island, right? Or do this and
Right.
that and
Yeah,
that. And
yeah.
it's like those are the best memories as a kid that I remember because I'm like, man, remember when we like almost died and we thought we were going to get complimentary breakfast, but we had to eat those crappy little ration sandwiches that they were having out, and you were hungry. So how, because your former military background, you're talking about reintegrating, and obviously, as a young man, probably at that stage in your life, everything is so rigorous, right, and
Yes.
structured, and the stakes are so high, right? And something that I've been leaning towards a little bit lately, as a former athlete, right, and by no means was it life or death, but I do understand the importance of efficiency, right, and precision, and training, right.
Right.
And having, let's say, one shot to do things oftentimes, right? Or just a few. As an artist, right? Or within our culture, I think what I'm finding a little bit more is just to kind of take things a little bit easier, if you know what I mean, right? Kind of let go of the
Yeah.
reins and understand that everything has a rhythm, right? Everything has a time and a place. And although it might not be your time and place right now for that situation, that doesn't mean that it's never going to be that opportunity is going to arise, tomorrow, next week, maybe next year, right? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, you go through what we call rigorous training or intensive training. That's what we call it. It's because they're in the military, they really try to gear you, especially in the Marines. They really try to gear you for combat. Everything revolves around combat. Every Marine is a rifleman, no matter what. Even if you're a glorified typewriter, you're a pencil pusher in the Marine Corps, guess what? They're going to train you for combat. You're a rifleman first, because we do have outposts to where we set up a whole logistical site. And sometimes those sites get ran over. You know, that we get insurgents that'll roll in, and we have to start breaking stuff down and start putting tents away and computers and all that kind of thing, and we got to move. And so you got to know how to fight, you know, so you have that intensity of, oh, I gotta fight, and you have to be trained for that. You got to go to the gym, you have to run, and we train some crazy ways of training. You know, we carry these packs on our backs, and we're carrying ammo cans, running with them filled with cement. You know, it's just nuts. We do crazy stuff because we have to have that mentality that we could die at any given moment in time. So reintegration, we come back out and we get into the civilian sector, and now the structure is gone. Now there's, we say in the civilian, we talk about it like it's a myth, right? Like, in this, we heard in the civilian world, you know, that there's this thing that's called an alarm clock, and you can shut it off anytime you want. You know, it's like, what? You know, it sounds funny. You know, that's how we talk, though. And we're like, you know, they say in the civilian world, you can sleep in. And like, you can wake up and you can eat whatever you want. And like, we talk about it like that, because that's how far away from civilized our normality we are, you know, apart we are from the civilian sector in comparison to being in the military. And so when you try to reintegrate it, it doesn't, there's a lot of things that are military culture, I want to say. It's a whole different thing in the military. In the Marines, there's two mindsets. You have the Marine culture, and then everybody who's what they call infantry or grunts, it's a whole other cult that's inside of another cult, and they're even crazier. And I was an infantryman, so I know, you know, it's like we're crazy. And even our own fellow Marines that are in every other department, every other job, they're like, grunts are freaking crazy. You guys are nuts, you know, or you guys are stupid, because it doesn't take a lot of smarts to shoot a gun. This and it's like, yeah, it actually does. You have to be pretty tactically sound and know when to pull that trigger, because there's a lot of rules and regulations that say you can and cannot pull a trigger. You know, so you got to be pretty smart. And sometimes there's people that are in your way that are on your side while you're aiming that rifle. And so all that structured, you know, is it's intensely structured. When we come out here, it's really hard to, I guess, adapt, because it becomes second nature. You know, when I got out, I still got up like 4 o'clock in the morning. I'll put my pack on and go running, you know. Even though it hurt, I would still go running, you know. And I would train like I was just getting ready to die, like I was gonna be in the biggest fight of my life. And it's just because that was normal to me. That was me giving up my humanity to become this machine, you know. And when you bring that to the civilian sector, it's very rough, because there's people that will test you. You know, policemen will test you, sheriff's department, they'll test you. They'll see you running on the street and they'll stop you, and then they'll give you a whole spill about how stupid you look, how dumb this and that and blah blah. And I was like, wow, I served my country for you to tell me what to do. That's amazing. You know, I would have rather you said thank you and been on your merry way, you know. But it's the way it is, you know. And bringing that into family, my family realized I was really quiet, because there was a lot of things that I guess are normal to them that wasn't normal to me, and I wanted to correct it. And I wanted to, like, you know, what the hell is that, you know, you know. And it was just that whole, you know, modality and mentality of, you know, intensity, speed and intensity. You know, fix it. Why are you doing this? Why are you older than me and you don't know this? You know, things like that. And it was rough. And but you know, I have to thank my creator, you know, thank my God that way. Because throughout all that, there's people that, you know, they're smart. They were older than me. They knew that I came out of there, and they started sharing with me stories. You know, all these old cultural stories. I'm like, you know, why did you choose me of all people? You know, and because they felt that, I believe they felt that I needed it, you know. And so that part in day to day, like I said, you know, I have all this thing that's going on. You know, I have this little boosting here, and I have some sales that I'm doing here, and I have the 501C. And then in between that, you know, all throughout all my travels in the Marine Corps, places that I've been, I met elders of different nations, different places, and they would tell me all these old cultural stories. And and even my father, being one of the late Jesu Villa, when he told me some stories when I was younger, and he told me these stories, when people are your age, they're not even going to know those stories. He goes, you're going to meet people that are my age, they're not going to know these stories. They're going to say they heard of it, but they won't really know the story. And sure enough, I came across people, and they were like, how do you know that story? My father told me it, or this old man told me it. And they were like, you know what? I know just a little bit of that story, but not the way you know it. So that it's like these stories go away, but these stories have life lessons that teach you something, how to save yourself, and teach you how to conduct yourself on a day-to-day basis. A lot of people think stories are, hey, they're just for kids and all this kind of thing. And in all actuality, there's a lot of lessons that could be reiterated to us as adults, And I find, to me, that's like my, right now, it's my saving grace. I really like to share all these stories. And every time I recite them, every time I'm saying them again, I learn something again all over, Maybe it's a reiteration, or maybe it's something brand new. Like, whoa, I never thought of that, And they tell
You
you
know
when you go to
what's
ceremony, you know the stories, you go to ceremony, guess what happens? The medicine
what?
that's happening at that ceremony reveals to you more parts of that ceremony, which is amazing. So it's a beautiful thing,
And hopefully we can get maybe one of those stories here in a second. But something that piqued my interest when you talked about maybe somebody, you serve your country and then you come back, and obviously you don't get the happiest of welcomes all of the time, or those thank yous, right? It's almost a little bit like a father, right? And I don't have kids, so I don't, I can just, I was a kid and I kind of get it a little bit of like, oh, dad just kind of goes somewhere, goes to work, and the kids never really understand what goes into keeping the bills paid and keeping the house afloat, right? They just kind of get to be kids. And there's got to be this balance, and I want to hear your take on it, to where it would be a little bit sad if the civilians in our country kind of knew the pain and suffering that it took to obtain the level of freedom that we have here, right? You see what I'm saying? You go somewhere like Afghanistan or Iraq, somewhere in the Middle East, and when the average person knows, hey, this is, these bombs go off and these things explode, and it's almost like, well, your job is to be a teacher, right? Like, your job is to be a mechanic. How is it that the mechanic has to walk around with the same struggles in lands like that, right? I wonder almost if there's a way to like still give that healthy respect and understand, like, hey, this is what happens, right? Like, almost like I think about it with hunting, right? Whenever I'll post a hunting video or somebody's killing something, or maybe the dog is tearing something apart, what's the initial reaction? Oh, it's violent. It's so bad, right? We can't do that. And I go, no. Oh, what do you mean? Where do you think the meat in your grocery store comes from, right? Do you think it just showed up to Sprouts, or you know what I mean, Albertsons, just all like that? No, you have to, somebody prepared that, somebody killed that animal and we're using it, right? And the idea of just like no harm should ever be done, or this and that, it's like, no, there's a balance. There should never be any forest fires. Well, how are they going to clear out the land for the new crops if there's never any fires, right? So you see what I'm saying with that analogy of like the hunting. You should know where your food comes from and have a healthy, representation of that. Just like we should know almost a little bit more about what our military goes through and our brothers and sisters that go over there, and make sure that I can sit here on a Zoom meeting on some fancy house, right? And be able to chat with you, because without those soldiers out there doing the work, we wouldn't be able to do this today, right?
So I guess I could say it, we bring every individual is going to bring something to the table when they join the military. Okay, for me, I grew up poor, right? My family came, they got separated we have a migration that started all the way from upstate New York, came down into Louisiana, across Mississippi, and then we ended up in Nevada. That's how my family ended up here in California. So during that time, there was a lot of racism going on, and they just knew that they could make money off of crops. They follow crops. Guess what? Make money, right? You blend in with, okay, if you put a black person, Asian person, and just hypothetically speaking, an indigenous person in one room, and there's 500 white folks. I'm sorry, sorry, not sorry, but guess who's gonna click with who, right?
The brown people.
Everyone that's of color is gonna hang out with each other because we know each other's struggle versus, them. They're just like great white sharks that want to cater to themselves, So it's kind of like that. So in a sense, we bring this story, a mentality that develops into the character, and that character pushes our personality into a place where in which is needed for us. So me, I grew up poor. I wanted more. I always wanted more, but I didn't know how to get that because all my family ever told me, even my cousins, my uncles, everybody in my family, that's all they ever told us. Work, work, work. You got to work. You got to work hard to have nice things. And so, and you got to be strong and you got to be fit because you have to do hard work. And that's all they ever told us ever since we were 3, 4 years old. All my cousins, we were, raking yards and cleaning roofs. And you think about it, we were little kids and we're doing work. Back in the day, the garbage can was like 4 feet tall. And if you couldn't get the garbage in there, you got your butt whooped because you were weak, And I was just like, dude, I can't, I had to be smart. And I was a skinny little kid. So to me, in my mind, I always had that. I have to work, I have to work, and I have to work hard. I have to. So that pushed in, I want to say it's like a very quantified notion, put me in a place when I joined the military. I wanted more. I had to drive myself to be more. So I worked out, and there was guys that were older than me, and I thought they were like superheroes because they ran fast and they could jump things and they could climb things. And I was just like, I gotta be like that, So I had to, me being a young person, I'm 19 years old, and I'm meeting guys that are 25 and even into the 30s, and they're doing like amazing superhuman stuff. And when I was in high school, yeah, I was breaking records. I could run a mile in 4 minutes in 10 seconds. I could swim 100 meters. I was on in aquatics, and I could swim 100 meters, in a minute and 10, And I'm just like, yeah, all right, cool. But like, this was different because this revolved around combat. And so I was like, oh man. So I had that mentality put you in a place where it creates the program for you. For me, it was work hard, be the best, work out so that you could be the best, so that you can be strong, so that you continue to be the best. And so that's where I took myself. And as I went into the intensity of the job, we read weapons manuals, we read leadership manuals, we read all these things that gear us for the next echelon up. When they teach Marines anything, you learn two echelons up. So if you're a private, you got to know what it is to be a corporal. Once you start getting into titles, platoon leader, squad leader, team leaders, thing like that, you got to know the next two echelons up. So if I'm a team leader, I need to know what a squad leader and a platoon leader, a platoon sergeant knows. And if I become a squad leader, I got to know what the platoon sergeant and the lieutenant knows. If I end up becoming the staff sergeant, he dies, guess what? I need to know, the lieutenant, and then the gunnery sergeant above him, I need to know what he knows. So they teach us that. So it's like you're constantly embedding yourself in this culture called the military, called the Marines, and you're giving up your humanity because you're trying to put forth every effort of yourself along with that motivation that you brought with you into the Corps, or into the military. So everybody has slightly a different story to where they're going to say, I wanted to do something that went above and beyond. I needed to do something that was different. I needed to try something that, or maybe this was my last resort. Jobs weren't panning out. It was too hard to make it. So I joined the military, and I knew that I could do it because I was young. I never heard a lot of these different stories, but in general, I believe it's just one of those things that a lot of young people do to they come across this choice of saying, either I'm going to do it or I'm not going to do it. And then when I get in there, I'll learn it, I'll conform, and I'll walk away with something, whether it's 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, or maybe the whole long haul, 20 years, And so to me, I guess to answer your question, this is what we go through when we go into the military. We bring a big giant, like I want to say it's like a staple something, and we bring that with us into the military, and then we base everything that we do off of that. And like me, I put my total time that when I became in charge, when I became a sergeant, I had 19-year-olds, 18-year-olds, and 20-year-olds right out of college, right out of high school. A lot of them were athletes, football players, cross country runners, all that kind of thing. And I had to be faster than them because I'm their instructor. I'm the guy in charge. So I'm just like, dang, I'm already hurting. And I gotta keep up with them. But yet I had guys that were in their 40s, and those guys were super in shape too. So I had to keep up with the old guys that had the experience, and then I had to be able to outshine the young guys because I'm the one in charge of them. So I gotta be the living example. I'm in the in-between place to where I gotta start thinking just a little bit smarter and not work so hard and figure out some loops in here and there and work out when they don't see me so that they look at me like I'm Superman, because that's what my higher ups did. They used to work out at midnight so that none of us young guys would see them. And we just thought they were made like that. Oh, you're a Marine, you just got upgraded to superpowers, And so, this is the things that we go through, and that mindset of embedding yourself, your totality into this type of job, you do lose yourself. It's hard to undo, and that's what people don't understand. We go through a great deal of boot camp. Is you're told when to wake up, you're told when to sit down, when to stand up, when to eat, when to shower, how to shower, how to eat, how to get dressed. Everything that is outside of what you would see yourself as an individual doing, you don't get to do any of that. You are not an individual. You are a part of a giant team, and that's what you do. And you have to learn the job first. And that's just boot camp. And they're teaching you how to run super fast with boots on, with packs on. When you get to your school, you're doing the same thing all over again. They're showing you the technicality behind your job, what it is to run with the weapon and blow things up while you have a man to your left and a man to your right, and what it is to take care of them and to make sure that they take care of you and you guys are operating as a cohesive unit. And then once you get out of school, you go into the fleet. And when you go to the fleet, they take all the schooling out of you and show you how they do standard operating procedures. And so now you may not have time to eat versus in school, and they make sure you eat. They got to keep you healthy because you have to graduate. The Marine Corps needs bodies. So when you get to the Marine Corps, they tell you, hey, sometimes you ain't going to eat. So sometimes we wouldn't eat for like maybe up to 24, 48 hours, even 72 hours, where we just get like a cracker or like something to drink. And that's what it was. And this is what happens. It's in real life, in combat, this is what. You might run out of food and you might not be able to hit a supply point. You're gonna have to learn how to just dig deep and make your body eat itself, and this is why we work out. This is why we train, so we understand the pain so that we can absorb that pain, know that pain, embrace that pain to go the distance. And people in the civilian world, they have no idea what it is to go through all that. You're doing anywhere from 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hour watches, where you're just awake, patrolling with a weapon in your hand, and you're waiting for somebody to cross the line. And there's standard operating procedures for that. You got to learn how to sound alarms. You have to log in when the date happened, because there's military documentation that's used as legal things when it comes down to a investigation. They investigate these things too. When you go to war, there's investigations that go on that justify whether we were able to shoot or not shoot, whether we were able to get dead or get somebody dead, either or. And so th this is so many levels. It's kind of in general, but it's so many levels of just bringing that intensity. You're trained to do something and it becomes second nature. And when we get out here, nobody really understands the totality of the job that we do and what it takes. To this day, I'm sure there's plenty of Marines or even soldiers or airmen or sailors that can recite something that they must have said that many times. I still know the mission of the Marine Corps Rifle Squad: to see, close with, and destroy the enemy by fire and maneuver, and to repel the enemy's attack by fire and close combat. That's the like. How do I know that? Because that's how many times I said it. That's how much it was a creed to us that
Yeah, it
when we
becomes
go
a
out there.
reflex. It becomes a reflex instead of a reaction, right?
Yes. And so it's like people are like, what? Do you still know the operating order, the M16A2 service rifle? I'm like, yes. I'm like, why do you know that? You don't need to know that, but that's That's how you know how to fix your weapon. If the operating cycle doesn't work, you have to take your weapon apart and put it back together. And, first find out what's wrong, put it back together, put it back together the right way so that you can fire again,
So now I have some questions on, you giving us that awesome backstory, right, on kind of how you came up with your career. And as you see the younger generations, me included, right, of maybe 20 years younger than you are, right, 15, 20 years, and you kind of start to plan, hey, how can you help, give back and help guide your community, which you're doing with your nonprofit, right, and what you're going to plan on doing with that. Here's the cool part with me is I know that I was given a lot of opportunities that my parents and my grandparents did not have, right? It was just impossible, right? The fact that I didn't necessarily have to go into the military, right? I was, it was on the cards where that was probably a path that I was considering taking. And I remember my grandfather was saying, no, we're not going to do that. Like, I did that so that you don't have to do that, right? And just kind of hearing that and me going like, but I think I'm a tough guy, right? I think I'm going to go do that. And he's like, no, you're going to go to school and then we're going to get out and then you're going to do a career, right? And you're going to help people with whatever it is that you're passionate about. And I remember one day I told this story, a couple episodes ago, but you'll be able to take it and put your own spin on it. I was gonna drop out of college before. I was taking this African American history class, and I was just like, I'm not feeling school anymore. Like, I want to go out and do things. I don't like going to school, right? And I remember this Mexican guy who was landscaping. It was around lunchtime. You could tell he'd already worked an 8-hour shift before lunch, and he was one of those guys. And he was getting his coffee, taking a break, and I'm like looking through my flashcards. I got my notepads out and stuff. And he sat down kind of at the seat next to me, and he goes, oh, are you in college? And I'd already quit 15 minutes before. Like I just said, I might as well have said no, like I'm not in college anymore. And he goes, oh man, I want you to like stay in school so that one day you don't have to work with your hands all day like I have to, and you can get paid with what's in your mind instead of what your body does, right? And I remember he told me that, and I was like, this guy's in his 60s. Clearly he knows more than I know. So I grabbed my flashcards and I went and, kept studying and ultimately passed the test and obviously, got my degree and stuff like that, and I work now. But the idea of, like he said, right, of scaling your mind instead of your body, you can accomplish so much more with your influence if that's your mentality, right? Because even your parents, and we'll get into your family lineage here in a couple minutes hopefully, but that was what you had to do. There was no other option. You had to go to the military because you guys were poor, right? You were ready to go, and you knew, hey, okay, if I can, here's the trade-off. If I can make it through this, they'll be able to take care of me for the after part, right? And that's the agreement. And it's just so kind of what I'm trying to do and what I see with my generation is you can do that if you want and it's needed, right? Natives are of the highest military service in any other demographic, right? Of all time, I think, if I'm correct, right? And actually understanding that, like, I'm growing right now as an investment advisor, right? I want to own a building one day. I want to own a humongous building where we're able to help as many people as possible, right? And when I was in these reports, and it's mostly older white guys in suits and ties. That's not my style, right? But just like you said a second ago, I ChatGPT'd it, and the percentage of Native American or indigenous people who are in the financial sector, it's half of a half of a percent, right? It's the tiniest thing ever, right? And there's a couple black guys in my office that'll be like, oh my gosh, 3% of financial advisors in the country are black, right? And I'm like, 3%? Okay, how about we go half of a half of a percent for my community? You know what I mean? To where it's like, we're not in a competition or anything here, but that's the finite, ability that you have to be able to understand. And that's gonna change, obviously, with my community, with guys like me going out and actually getting those degrees and actually acquiring those skills in that craft. That way we're not getting paid for our bodies anymore and we're not in that sector, right? So kind of with your non-for-profit or what you see kind of with the future and the guidance, are you kind of maybe thinking a little bit about that lane at all?
I was thinking about like employment, through grants, things like
Yeah.
that. Because once you develop a financial plan, there's stipends and there's ways to send money out to contractors. Like, let's just say I wanted to have a beading class, and someone that I might know in the community doesn't have a job right now, but they can bead really well, and they have some ins and outs. Hey, come and teach a class, man. We'll get you paid up, and that's on that lower level. For 501Cs, you can open up a small subsidiary housing, and you can, like, one bedroom studio apartments, maybe two or three units, and you can rent those out, and you can leave it at a monetary price to where it's like cheapest living you could ever get. But because you're operating off of what they would call donations, it's a fixed income. So you can draw in money and then use that as program to help your subsidized housing for people in need. So these are other things to provide community members with. People who are struggling, you're giving back to the community, and it's a bigger business process. But I don't want to miss a step here. I want to be able to start off. Okay, let's start off here. Let's get a couple grants, start bringing some people in, work some small programs for scholarships for young people, get them books so that, like you said, go to college. If I knew what I know now, then I probably wouldn't have went into the Marine Corps, because there were so many different ways they could have just broke down what it is to go get FAFSA, what it is to go get, certain grants that you don't have to pay back, or even if you got certain loans, there's loopholes in doing a community service to where you're paying back, quarter at a time, but you're doing community service to equate the amount that was handed to you. So I'm just like, man, if I would have known all that, it would have been a whole different story.
Or here's the hardest hurdle, right? And this is something for me, right? Which is allowing those older community members who have been through the ringer, like yourself saying, right, and actually being able to accept that assistance, right, out of love, out of just, hey, the ability to, hey, if you succeed, we all succeed, right? Because I know you're going to give it back, and you don't all have to do it all on your own. That's that generational planning, right? That's that, how do we actually go in and improve the tribes, right? People living on the res, people living off the res, you got to understand that you don't have to do it all alone. And if you're actually going to build something of scale, of substance, it's impossible to do it all alone, right? You need different players. You need different players. You need coaches. You need, experts in all these different fields, so you can come together and actually have something that is rock solid. And like you're saying a second ago, like, you don't want to skip any steps, right? You don't have enough hours in the day to do it all,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. Nobody's really self-made, and that's the things that I'm finding right now. I have a lot of people. I just mentioned this to a couple of my friends, and they're like, "Hey, man, I know these people over here. I know people at the California Endowment. I know, and just let me know when you have everything set, dude. We'll start. I know how to draw a pitch up. And we can do this." I'm just like, "Wow!" Like, I didn't expect that, but they already knew. Okay, hey, this guy's kind of young. And he has some experience. He knows how to do managing and tasker trackers and things like that. But let's get him the actionable part about it. All we gotta do is just cross this threshold, and we can get, your foundation paid. So I'm just like, right on, dude. I appreciate that. So I'm learning. Like, I was thinking I was gonna have to do this thing all by myself, but people heard, and it was like, hey, we're gonna help you out. Draw a permission statement, and we'll throw a pitch behind it, and we'll get you some funding. I'm like, right on, dude. So it's one of those things that I look at, even from, my cultural background. My mother's Seneca, raised Seneca, and out of Six Nations. And my father, he was Apache, and the struggles that I heard them go through when they were young, and what it was to grow up and go into the workforce and try to make it as a minority. And like I said, you think about the early 30s all the way into the 50s. There was a lot of this back and forth, silent racism going on, and it was hard to make it, and fortunately my mom did up to 30 years in the hospitality business, where she opened up hotels and things. And this is somebody that didn't even have a full-on GED. My mom didn't make it through school, and she was a single mom raising us. So it's just like, wow, that was nuts. And she made it. So that's a wonderful thing to know that, okay, hey, just a little bit of focus, all that drive of wanting more. Like I said, I still have that. That's where I went into the Marine Corps, the more, and then my father, he was in the military, he was in the Air Force,
But they
and he
weren't,
just
were
had
they
a mind.
together or they weren't together?
Oh, they met each other somewhere in between, and so my father, he was in the Air Force, and then he somehow just got, he was inspired by weapons, he was inspired by guns, and so he learned how to become an arms dealer, and he was selling, handguns and rifles to the military and to the police force, and that's how he made his money. And then on top of that, he was a nurse. He was a full on ready scale nurse out of the military, and I was just like, wow. So it just takes a little bit of somebody, and I'm pretty sure somebody put it in their ear, do this and you can do this, but you have to do this first, and that's where I believe that they got it from. And then hearing their stories, I was like, man, I can't. My mom was trying to make it just off of what she was making, raising us. And then so I was like, man, it was enough to get by, but I used to envy kids who had, their Air Jordans and Adidas and name brand stuff, but I was just like, I gotta do better than this when I grow up. I gotta make sure that I stay on track. And it was kind of hard, and so, but I can say, coming from a cultural background, what our people been through to make things survive today, certain parts of our culture are erased because of, colonizers and, oppression, religion, things like that. But some of those things we actually fought for, some of our ceremonies, we actually really fought for those things. And now we have them to this day. And it's to say, let me fight for myself for something that I believe in. My belief right now is, it was my, well, at the time was my continuity. How am I going to make it? So I didn't take no for an answer. Anybody told me no, I'm like, no, nah. Even if I was BSing the whole time, I made sure I had a nice, confident, straight face, and I made that lie the biggest truth in the world, and they bought it, and I got the job, and so that's that drive and that fight, and they say that we receive stuff, from our ancestors, and it lives with us, and it's just tapping into it and saying, I can do this. I mean, Geronimo fought till he was 67 years old, man. Like, how does a 67-year-old, old man ride horses and hold a rifle while he's galloping on a horse? It's like, that's nuts. So that's an inspiration. That's one of our war chiefs. And so I kind of think, like, man, I go, hope when I'm 67 years old, I could ride a horse and shoot a rifle at the same time.
I hear that. What do you remember about your grandparents? Where did they grow up?
Oh, so you know what? We have a mysterious, weird. I don't know if this is all natives or it's just our family, but we had this strange, mysterious background when it comes to my grandparents. So apparently, my grandpa was he was a major minority. He came up in the religious sector. He was a doctor of doctors. I can't believe that. It's really strange, him not having that much of an educational background. He had a doctorate in theology, and so he became a reverend, and he helped establish the Spanish Church of God here over here in Central Valley, all the way up to Lodi. So a lot of these churches that they call Iglesia de, excuse my Spanish, Iglesia de Dios, right? So it's a Church of God, but it's a Spanish Church of God. So he learned Spanish really, really fast because he worked in the farms. Like I said, my family followed crops, so that's where he learned all that. And so he opened up a church, and then later on he got booted out of the church because there's religious rules and principles you have to follow. So my grandpa, he used to eat pigs and he used to eat innards from the animals because he was native, dude. We eat everything. And they said, well, the Bible says you can't do that, so we can't have you in our church because you're setting a bad example, this and that. And then my uncles, they were all that great. They were in and out of prison, so that was another thing. And so, but I'm thinking about my grandpa as a minority making it. And like, he used to sit down with us and talk. He used to sit down and talk with us, talk about life and talk about how to make it, and He always tried to fix things all the time. If the car broke down, you'd see him underneath that car all day fixing that thing, you know. And he always wore his coveralls all the time, and he always wore a belt with coveralls. We don't know why he did that, but he just did, you know. And you know, he would sit there and he would play his church music. He played an organ. He played accordions and he played guitar. He was a musician, but you know, he loved God. But when it came down to the realness of him explaining, you know, what it is, he would say, "Not all of this over here, this religion is true," you know. He because he knew he was educated, you know. And he says, "But the church says this is what we have to say," you know. But that was just his passion. That's where he found his niche, and that's where he found his voice, being able to talk to people and lead people and bring people up that way, you know, raise people up. You know, my grandma, she was of a strange origin. We don't know where she came from. Apparently, my grandpa had married like seven. He had seven wives,
Oh,
so
geez.
we don't know, you know. And they all
Imagine doing
died,
that today.
you know. They died somewhere down the line, and my grandma just ended up with him, and then that was just it, you know. And she was a quiet person, but she worked hard. We used to see her early in the morning just chopping animals up, you know, just early in the morning, big old cleaver, getting ready to cook for the whole family. And all my uncles and older cousins, they would come to my grandma's house and they'd fill up their lunch boxes to go to work. And guess what kind of jobs they had? You know,
Yeah,
back
blue
busting
collar.
jobs. You know, they were raising steel and laying down cement and heavy construction, things like that, because that's all we knew. You know, nobody educated us on how to get an education, you know, things like that. So my grandparents were pretty humble people, and at the same time they really helped out a lot of the community on so many different levels. And they didn't see anybody different. You know, if you were black, you were black. If you were Asian, you were Asian. You were Mexican, you were Mexican. You were Native, you were Native. They wouldn't treat anybody different, and they would try to feed you all the time. They still knew people from the farms. So they had fresh vegetables, fresh meat, everything, and they would go hand these groceries out to all these different families from all over the place. And people used to just come to my grandma and grandpa's house. We didn't know who half these people were, but you know, they knew who they were. And we'd always see them walk away feeling happy, you know, just always had a smile on their hand, and you smile and a handshake, and you know, go back to their vehicles and go home. And we just like ask my mom, "Hey, who's that?" "I don't know. They're probably from the church or someone they know or something, you know." But you know, that's how far their reach, my grandma and grandpa's reach, was in California. They really helped out a great deal of people all over the place, and they never had this sense of, you know, praise, and they never did it without any kind of reprieve in that sense. But they were just humble people that really loved, you know, the way that they wanted to pray, or how they learned how to pray, or however you can put it, and they helped. And that's all they did, you know. And I think I see my nobility coming from them growing up as a little tyke, you know, running around, you know, from 3 to 7 years old, watching what they did a lot of the time.
I
So
hear that, ma'am. And how many siblings did you grow up with?
before my mom remarried, it was myself and my older sister. And then somewhere down the line, we ended up meeting some sisters from my mister, and some brothers from another mother, you know. So my dad was my father, my birth father. You know, he was into sowing his oats, so we had a whole nother litter out there somewhere, you know. We had four other half brothers and two half sisters that were out there. And later on, as we got older, we ended up meeting up, and they kind of told us our father's story and this and that. And like, oh,
Are you
okay.
guys fairly close today?
So we know who we know who each other is, and we tried to do the whole, like, you know, get to know each other. But we grew up in different eras. We had a different mindset, you know. And then some of them grew up really close with my father, so they know the ins and outs of him. We only knew one side of him, and it's all those family dynamics, you know. And so, and then you
It's
have the adulting.
complicated.
You know, the adulting, you know, we got to go to our jobs and all that kind of thing. So we didn't really have a lot of time for each other. But when we see each other, we acknowledge each other. We say hello, we try to spend, you know, have a meal or whatever. And then, until we cross each other again over the next millennia, you know, we'll see each
I
other.
get it. Are you married?
No,
Okay.
I'm a very disease-free single individual.
I hear that part. I hear that part. So as you talked about building on those generations though, and understanding, man, it is an interesting mindset though, because the coolest thing that you said is like, had I known now what I knew, you know what I mean? What I didn't know then, I would have done something different. Well, you have that influence now. Like you just have to find the right mentees, right? The right open flowers to water so that they can continue to take those reins, right? Is that something that you're excited about currently?
Right now it's I have a push pull towards that. And it's just because there's so many strange barriers, and then there's so many strange, I guess, mentalities. So here in the Central Valley, in the Fresno area, I want to say it's mostly just the Fresno area. Not the entire valley, but mostly right here in Fresno. The natives here have this really strange mindset of like you have to ask permission to do anything. And the
I've
people that you
heard
ask
that.
permission to, you have to, they're not even from here. The people that they look to are w from way up north. They're all the way from like Bayside, Vallejo, San Francisco area, all that. And it was like, and they're not even from the tribes that are from here, but they tell them to call the shots for the people down here. Really, really strange. So they have this
Dude,
strange
I
romanticism.
can't believe, no, we got to stay on that for a second, 'cause I've been blessed so much with great mentorship and great coaching around me to where I don't ask for permission. You know what I mean? Like that's not my first thought is, are we allowed to do something? We fucking do it, and then if it's illegal or against the rules, we get a little notice on our door, right? And we go, "Oh, we need to readjust, right? Like apparently we're out of bounds. We need to get, I understand we're out of bounds. Let's get back in bounds now, right?" But like it's so funny because some of the things that I'll, ideas that I'll bring back to my tribe, right? Or hey, we should get this going. Or maybe the most recently was at the Cal State Long Beach powwow, because I went to Cal State Long Beach for college, right? I'm an alumni. And the weirdest thing was I was like, hey, I'm going to do something a little different as far as documenting this year's powwow, right? Whoa. You gotta ask the committee, are they gonna know, this and that? And I'm like, the fuck does a committee know about drones? I'm the expert here. What are you talking about? Like I do all this. Think about the show, right? Or the podcast. Can I film while you're on there? Oh, you gotta ask somebody. They don't know what they're talking about. What do you mean? It's just funny, right? To have that mentality that you brought up. It's so true.
Yeah, they have a strange romanticized, you know, there has to be a chief or something involved. And then I'm just like, wow, like you guys don't even know what it is to be a tribe, let alone a lot of these California natives here that I know up here, they don't really have a culture. They've been so annexed by their oppressors and their colonizers that I've never seen, and these people that come and do all this, they're not even federally recognized. And when I've actually traced back where they come from, I was like, wow, you guys are not even from here. You guys just settled in our river system because there was food and water right there. You guys came from somewhere else. And then, you know, archaeologists and all that, they just labeled you as, oh, well, because you were here, you know, you're labeled as you lived here, you know. But in all actuality, their stories and their origins, in according to some of their elders, they're not from here. They migrated here from the other side of the Sierra Nevadas. And I was like, oh, that's why so their name is Chimnumni, right? But the name Numa is in their language. Numa comes from the Bishop Paiutes that are on the other side of 365, 395, and that's going towards Big Pine let me see, Big Pine, and it's Bishop Paiute area. Bishop, there you go, Bishop. So it's in that area. So those there's some strange descendants that were up on the mountain in the Sierra Nevadas that came from the Bishop Paiutes, and then they eventually made it over the mountain and they settled here in what they would call King's River. You know, I mean, King's
And
River, it's
the way
not even
I'm
a real
thinking,
river. It was built by us. We built it with machines.
That is funny. It's not even a it's a man-made river. You're,
Yes,
there's
Miami
no
River.
history in it. That's funny. But the way I'm looking at it is like it, the people who oppressed you didn't ask permission to do what they did to you. So why is it that you have to ask permission to go back to those ways? You know what I mean? To take
Yeah.
control of whatever it is that you're doing or continue to perform. It's shady. That's what it is. It's
Yeah.
real
And
shady, you know?
what I find is, especially when it comes down to like belief, you know, they try, oh, you can't set up a sweat lodge without permission.
Yeah.
Like, and you have to do it the right way. Okay, well, what's the right way? Because when I received my pouring rights as a spiritual leader, like we set up fire like before the sun came up, and that fire had already been going from the time we went in. So like 5 o'clock, we're awake and we're setting up wood for fire, and then that fire starts get going roughly about 5:45, because it takes a little while for it to build up. 6 o'clock, this gets the blazing. We walk into sweat lodge at 10 o'clock. I didn't get out of that sweat lodge until 2 in the morning. And I'm just like, can you do what I do? Like, you're telling me how to do it, but you can't do it. But you're trying to get people to go tell me to go do it. Like, wait a minute, what? And then you're telling me I have to ask permission so that I can go do all that all over again? Like,
You
what?
know, that's probably super different too from your career in the military, because I'm assuming most of your leadership had at least been through those ranks previously, right? So
Yes.
they had active, you know, experience doing it. So
Yeah.
when you, hey, we do it this way, because I was there when we did it this way, not
Yeah.
because in theory this might work, right?
Yeah, in theory, exactly. Yeah. And it's just it to me, I find it very strange here. It's like I was living in San Diego at one time, and the natives over there were so welcoming. I would sit there, I was just like, wow, this is amazing. They're like, what do you mean? I go, you ever think about apostolics and Pentecostals and Catholics and Christians? They actually will come to your door to make sure you go to church. I go, where I live, there could be a sweat lodge right down the street from me, and they know I'm native, and they will never ever come to my door and say, hey, you want to come and pray? You want to come and, you know, come to ceremony? You know, might save your life or whatever you're
No
going through, you can go pray
community,
about.
huh?
Yeah, and it's like, and they were not like that over here where I live right now, and it's nuts. But yet the people down in San Diego, man, those Kumeyaays and everybody that's down there, they were so just welcoming, man. And even the Mexica people, they were just so welcoming. Hey, come to our temezcal, come to our teepee meetings, man. I was just like, wow, this is amazing. The whole native community is looking for each other, and they'll say, hey, there's a powwow going on, come to the powwow. They don't even know you. They just hit you up on Facebook. Hey, there's a powwow, come to it. We'll meet there. We'll talk there. I'm like, wow. So to me, it feels strange here because these people still have that men they have a mentality where they're cliquish. They only listen to each other. And if there's an outsider that comes in and you reveal their boundary, they'll hate you for it because they don't want to evolve. They don't want to grow anymore. They like it stagnant. They like it to where everything has no noise to it. There's no evolution. And it's like, wow. And then you have this hierarchy that's strange because the people that are saying you have to ask permission are not even from this area, you know. And then the people that are barking that their tribe is not from here, you know, they're not from Fresno, you know. And it's like the Chimnumnees, they're from past Trimmer Lake. So I'm just like, you're not even from here, bro. You're trying to be a mobster and say you got to do what we say. And then they have no, and then they keep bugging you about it. They'll say it to the whole community here, and people will probably, hey man, I heard some bad shit about you, man. Da, 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 da. And I'm just like, wow, okay. So what is it? And it's all internal politics. You know, it's all internal politics. And I'm just like, what does that have to do with the law? You know, you can't
And
use the
think
word tribe. You have 501c3 and you can't use the word tribe in it. Like, did you know that tribe is actually a Greek Roman Latin word? It means to split up. It means tribus, triangle, three. Tribus, it means to split into three. That's what it means. That's a bureaucratic term. You know, oh well, and then one of the organizations I was working with, they're called Kuksu, and Kuksu is a northern Pomo word that's not coined. It's not coined. It's not copywritten, right? The name just simply means belief. So they called themselves Kuksu Nation simply because they all had the same religious belief. They're all from different tribes, but they wanted to commemorate the people of California and use the word Kuksu, use their word of belief. And that's what they wanted to, that's what they wanted to do. And these people came over, "You can't use that word. You can't, that's a POMO word." And I was like, "You know that word is not coined or copywritten?" And they were
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
and when you school them with the law, they don't like it either, And so they go around the community, start, what are they, they kind of like harass you through other people,
Of
And it's
course. A
like,
lot of
you have to
barking,
go,
a lot of barking, not a lot of
not a
biting,
lot of
right?
bite. And it's just weird because it feels like, wow, it almost feels like they really adapted to what it is to be a colonizer, And they're pretty much colonizing other natives in the way that they think. And these people here, they just bastardize a lot of stuff. It like there are four directions. There are four directions. They pined it off of the Lakotas, And they're real quick to use these terms, Mithaq, Oyasin, and all to all my relations and all this kind of thing. And I'm just like, why do you guys, that's not from your people. Like, you have different terms and it's inside your guys' creation story. Those creation stories help guide you to know who you are. That's why they're your guys' creation stories. Why are you guys taking something from somewhere else? You're appropriating, it's okay that you're native and you're appropriating something that's native. That's wonderful, but I believe that you should know who you are first,
It's not period correct. Like, it's not, like, cool, you can take something off a 68 Mustang, there's still Mustangs, but now the 70, you're like, it's not, it's a little off, right? You're in
it's
the
a little
same
off.
family. Yeah, I got you.
And it's
Dude.
just it's hard to to me it's hard to be out here because it's just so many cliques. They only
Yeah.
cater to themselves, and you're like, I was born here and grew up here, and I've been around a lot of these people. And when I left to the military, I didn't know these people for up to 19 years before I got back here, And so now I see them. A lot of them had kids, and they're all grown up, And they act the same as their parents did, And they have the same clique mentality. So when I'm trying to interject, like, oh hey, I can help you with this. I can bring this to the table for you if you need, outside native influence. And they're like, no, we have people for that. I'm just like, you mean you have the same people for that? I go to these rallies here and it's always the same speakers over and over again talking about the same thing and doing the same thing. And I'm just like, you guys haven't got, you guys didn't learn to fly yet. Like, you got feathers, but you didn't learn how to fly.
I like that.
It's one of those things that I feel sad about because reintegration, it goes into that. I'm supposed to feel for these people, but it hurts that much to where I'd rather be plugged right back into that military machine and be like, no, nah, I want to be vulnerable. Let me close the hatch. Let me turn on all the switches and let's gear up for war. And I have all this armor, I'm tough and I'm invincible. But those machines don't have, a warrant to be in these civilian sectors, And so it kind of hurts because I believe in people. I'm like Luke Skywalker and everybody else is Darth Vader, and I believe there's good in them, And when there's not, it tears me apart. I just get like broken and I'm just like, man. And then I let all that in when they're talking the mess and I let it all in and it brings me down. And I'm just like, wait a minute, man, I served my freaking country for you guys to make me feel like this. This is some messed up stuff, man. I would rather you guys said thank you and be on your merry way, And so sometimes I just got to sit and just, I pull my big boy pants up and, and say, you know what? I've done more in my life than you will ever do in your entire life, And it's sad to say that, but Ronald Reagan said it the best. People go through life wondering if they ever made a difference. Marines don't have that problem. So it's like, I know I've done something no one else can do. It's the hardest branch of service you could ever join, and it's hard to make it through. And if you don't make it, that's a mark on your record for life. You went to the Marines and you didn't make it. That's the hardest branch because even the Army will say you the it's hard. I've worked with Navy SEALs, and they're just like, dude, how do you guys just smoke and joke? It's freezing. You have hail landing on you, and you guys are digging fighting holes, laughing and lighting cigarettes, and it's freaking cold as hell. And we're way out in this middle of nowhere place in Afghanistan. And these are Navy SEALs. These are like total badasses, and they're looking at us grunt like, how are you guys doing? You guys actually enjoy yourself? And we're just looking at them like, no, this is terrible. This is the most terrible thing we ever had to do. And they're just like, well, you guys look like you guys are having fun. I go, because it's our job. Like, this is normal. To us, every climb in place, you know, it's like there's no such thing as weather. There's no such thing as gravity. There's no, everything that we're taught, there's no such thing as that we can do anything we want, you know. And they're just like, damn. They're over here. They broke into some compound. They lit a fire and they're all warm and cozy in there. We're out sleeping in the cold, freezing mud, dude, and like nothing. And
I
so
wanna.
that mentality, you know, that mentality kind of keeps me going. When I let the hurt come in, I gotta remember I've been through some hard stuff already. I don't have to let it, you know.
I like that. That's awesome. Well, here, I wanna. Well, we'll start to land the plane here, you know, in a second, but I want to not, you know, blow past your work as a spiritual leader, right? And I want to hear a little bit about that and kind of your journey and your process behind, you know, what you're trying to accomplish within that realm.
Oh, within there, coming into that, it wasn't something that I kind of sought, you know. The story always starts out like my mom would say, "Hey, you were born 2 pounds, 2 ounces. You know, you were pretty much supposed to be dead. You know, you're a missing twin." And in our culture, that's a big thing. To Apaches, being a twin is almost like being you're just a superhero automatically. You know, and it's just because of our origin stories about our hero twins, it has a lot of makeup to how twins actually act, or even how a missing twin acts in their life. There are certain traits that revolve around those origin stories. So we're not separate from a story in comparison to ourselves. It's not something that's old and then we're bringing it up as brand new. No, we are a part of that all the way down to the beginning of that origin story. And so they say these things just land on you. Person that has the hardest life is going to receive the responsibility to help because they know what it is to not have. So during my life, you know, I got stationed in Hawaii, and when I got stationed there's a lot of natives there. Throughout one entire year, 50,000 natives rotate through the state of Hawaii because there's so many military bases there. So you have families that go there. They leave, cycle, so on and so forth. Some of them actually stay there, raise families there, you know. So I'll come across elders that were there. They were visiting one of their grandchildren or one of their sons or daughters, and they'd pull me off to the side. They would tell me a story. And these cultural stories, though it sounds just like a cultural story, there's spiritual parts in those cultural stories. And those spiritual parts tell you how to conduct a ceremony, what instruments, what things are used in that story and how to attain them, and also how to respect them in regards to they're not, it's not an inanimate object. It's actually a living, breathing thing. It's a sentient being that comes to life when you add life to it. And these things were hard for me to understand. I was young, I was dumb and young, you know, I'm in my 20s and I'm just trying to start a family. You know, I've been married like 3 times. So I have a child with just one of my exes. But I wanted, to me, that drive to teach my daughter all these cultural things. I really wanted to be able to pass that on to her. So I did my best to retain everything I've ever heard from like a Hopi elder. He told me a story. He told me a story about they call him the Eagle Boy, and he told me that once a old man screamed and it echoed in a canyon. And when that echo went to the canyon, a rock burst and it turned into an eagle. And when that eagle fell down like a rock, it landed on the ground and it turned to a boy. And that boy was known as Eagle Boy. And every time he would whistle, it was like all the bad that was in your life would get blown away like that. And I remember that story, you know. And that's a short version, but I remember that story. So I go, okay, so that eagle whistle has a power to it. There's something to that eagle whistle, you know. So to me, that was something I had to remember. That instrument is that he blew was an eagle bone whistle, right? So the eagle has some power. So me thinking about how am I going to use that in later on in life. So as I, you know, continued throughout my career, I would hear other stories from other people. You know, hey, remember this story, you know, and I learned one about the flicker, you know, it's a woodpecker, and that woodpecker listens to the tree, and it's listening for like ails, it's listening for sicknesses, and the tree will let it know, And when it does, it'll pull those worms out on the of the tree. And when it does that, the tree remembers it. The tree tells it you can put food here. And so those woodpeckers will store food. They'll put seeds inside that tree. And they'll fly off. They'll do the mig their migration and come back. And they'll always know that tree, and that tree will always know that bird, and it'll have food there. So they say in ceremony, we use those woodpecker feathers to brush onto people to relieve them of sicknesses, because that's what that bird does. It removes the sickness, you know. And so these stories help guide us with these things. It mentions the bird. It mentions what we're supposed to do. It mentions all these things. When we hold that in respect of understanding it and applying it, we can look at anyone that asked for help and really, really, really believes in that help, that spiritual help. Hey, I'm going to help you. This is what these things are. And then now I can explain it to them. I'm not just going to pull an instrument out and use it. You know, I can tell them this is where that story came from. This is what this means. This is what this is used for. So you have an understanding, and then go through the ceremony and help heal them. And so being a spiritual leader, coming across these stories help me understand what I need to do for the patient or whoever's asking for help. And my vision with it is not anything big. You know, people say, oh, he's a medicine man, he's a holy man, he's a holy person, this and that. I'm like, yeah, that's great. It's not my forte. I'm not going to accept that title, this and that. Maybe that's what I'm doing. I'm just a man. And I just been happen to be blessed with these instructions. I happen to be blessed with a belief that there's almighty supernatural being, that all I got to do is pray to him, pray to her, pray to its existence, and it'll help us. You know, it'll come and help. And all these things that are around us have a life, you know. It has a life, and if we have an understanding what it is to respect those things in life, they will help us, you know. So when you feed the grass, you know, that's water being put in the grass. That water makes the grass take the carbon dioxide out, and it gives us air. We need to understand how to respect that, you know. Don't hurt those things. Don't hurt our trees. Don't hurt our, you know. Have a sense of respect when you know gather those medicines from those plants, you know. And so when I think about when people come my way, I'm not gonna go press myself on them the way, like, you know, they're aggressive Christians and Mormons and things like that, and they'll try to push the whole Jesus Christ on you and this and that. I'm not one of those people. I just say, hey, this is what I believe in. If you really have a faith in this old way of life, then if you need help, just ask, you know. And this is the way it works. And that's it. So I'm not one of these people that pushes those things. I just say, okay, I'm a traditional medicine practitioner. This is what I do. If you believe in it, then you believe in it. If you don't, you don't. If you're willing to give it a try, I will do my best to pray for you in this way, as long as you believe, you know. And if you trust in it, you know, don't trust in me. I'm just a man. You know, I believe that we're all vessels. We're all vessels, and we can be filled up with the Creator's likeness, and that likeness will help people. You know, it'll spill out on the people. And so when the Creator decides to use me, I always say in all ceremonies, I'm just letting the spirit do what it needs to do. I don't want to control anything here. We do have protocols that need to be followed because that's the traditional way of doing these ceremonies. But at the same time, I'm not going to put my hands on it to force it. I'm going to let the creator, let the spirit take control of this, and let the spirit work. And you'll see how it's going to work if you believe in this way. Trust is the application of faith. You know, so those things are tied two and two. So that's how I kind of envision what it is to and apply to what it is to hold that label of spiritual leader. You know, I kind of just say spiritual liaison, because when you lead somebody, you have responsibility to lead them the right way, versus I'm just talking to the creator for somebody, and I'm teaching them how to talk to creator. So I'm just a liaison in between you. Let me tune you in to the right frequency. Let me train you how to turn these knobs. And eventually you'll line those right knobs up to the right notches and frequencies to where now you can do it. And now you no longer need me. You know, I'm just here to guide you. Now you'll learn how to turn your knobs, and you'll get there, you know. And so that's how I kind of see what it is. So I don't really call myself a spiritual leader. I just say, oh, I'm just a spiritual liaison. I'm just this in-between person that's gonna kind of I'm gonna teach you how to move the knobs, and then from there you'll learn how to tune in on your own.
Man, I love hearing it. I appreciate you for taking the time and, obviously sharing as much as you've shared. I like to close out every single episode we do with two final questions. And the first one, you don't have to have an answer to. I just want to see if it takes us anywhere. And is there any, it's basically, is there anything that I didn't get a chance to ask you yet that you maybe wanted to come on and share a little bit more or highlight? It could be, culturally related, non-culturally related, it doesn't matter. Just anything that's been on the top of mind that we didn't get to cover. Is there anything that you wanted to kind of close off with?
Well, I would say I have something, and I usually want to. It's usually the thought of the day, and like the thought of the day is, in all history, if you can fathom what it is to see history overlapping itself, all in one cohesive movement, from slave trade to manifest destiny to the reservation, the beginning of the reservation era, to inside civil wars, to confinement, down to the modern era of machines, all at the same time, and seeing it as a whole intertwining realism, not idea, but realism. The question is, how should we think about American indigenous identity and its intersections with other racial identities? To me, that is where we, as indigenous peoples, can come to an understanding of what it is to bridge the gap between ourselves and decolonizing our minds amongst ourselves. And so that was just one of those big things that I always like to put out there, because nobody really understands that. You can't, there's black people that identify as being native, being indigenous. And yet they have some very strong ties when you start doing geneticist tests and things like that. It's like, wow, they're like almost 100%. They just happen to look black, you know? I know a lot of Muskogees that look totally white, and they have green eyes and blue eyes, and they look totally white. And a lot of them are, over 86%. But it's just that Scottish or Irish just happens to show up that way. And how did that happen? How do we look at them and identify them as an indigenous identity during the time where those intersecting timelines crossed each other and made that happen, and how do we view that? Because I'm mixed. I'm Seneca, I'm Apache, and I'm Otomi from, we have people that are down in the Sierra Madres in Mexico. So it's like, I look Mexican, but to Mexicans, I don't look Mexican. They're like, he's a weird looking Mexican dude, like, right? Because I'm mixed, and then the Senecas look at me and they're like, hey, that guy's really Apache, hey, he was, but when he turns out, he looks like the guy that's on the carton of the Seneca cigarettes, because I'm Seneca, there's certain angles that look that part. I go to Apache land and they immediately think, okay, he speaks Apache a little bit, but he really looks like something else. You don't look regular Apache, So when you come from a confined area, when it's just a reservation, and you have to think outside the box, that's a really valid question right now. How do we have that precept on American indigenous identities when we have the intersecting timelines and cultural intersections, And so
Yeah,
that
and
was one of the things that.
it's definitely going to have to be a contrary thought to the idea of, oh, you got to ask somebody, right? You got to, who's it? Because I can tell you right now, nobody, the sky's not going to open up and just give the answer, right? We're going to
No,
have to come up
no.
with the answer together. How does that happen? Proper communication, right?
Proper
Proper
communication,
leadership.
exactly.
Who becomes a leader? I come from the world of sports. Whoever's scoring the fucking ball, all right? That's who
Right,
the leader is, right? Oh,
exactly.
you got Michael Jordan over there? Yeah, we're going to listen to what he's saying, all right? Because
Right,
that guy knows how to
exactly.
put the oh my
And how do we
gosh,
create a
yeah.
narrative for you? How do we publish that, How do we put that into a book and then insert that into American academia so that we're understood that way? I'm not trying to talk about no DIE kind of thing, but I mean, we do have sovereign nations that are that are here in this place we call Turtle Island or the Americas, you know, and we forget about our cousins that are across the border, you know, on both borders, you know. They didn't cross the border crossed them, you know. So
Yeah, for
and
sure,
so it's
yeah.
one of those things because it's a whole continent, you know, Canada and Mexico, it's all one continent. So how come the federal natives look at the Mexicans like, oh, they're not indigenous people, they're Native Americans. And they are. They can trace their lineage all the way back to the first village they came from. Literally. And very easy too. It's simple versus a lot of natives here can't do that because there were so many different migrations. Versus all the Mexicans just got pushed down at one time down into Mexico. Okay, here's your country. There you go. Have at it. We'll put a wall up now.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, but definitely, well, we're barely just scratching the surface, you know. We'll definitely have to have you back on again and kind of extend out each one of these little seeds that we were able to plant in today's episode if you're interested. I'm excited to do that at a future date. But the last thing I like to ask is my favorite question because it helps me and the show get into certain narratives that I couldn't have predicted just with my own brain. And this is your time to shout out some of those good spirits and some of those good people that you know within your, you know, community or travels. And you can do that right now when I ask who are maybe two to three people that you know that you'd like to see me reach out to and hopefully see if they're interested in sharing a little bit of their story, just like you have on a future date. Who comes to mind first?
My adopted powwow niece, her name is Kat Warren, beautiful Danae, young woman. I've watched her grow up, mid-teenager all the way to her graduation. She got a bachelor's in Native Studies, and it's a cool story to see her come from her origins from Navajo country and being raised traditionally and you know, keeping her language alive and still practicing their original Navajo ways, and then bringing that into the modern spectrum of American academia, and then out of nowhere just falling into leadership roles in UC Riverside, and taking control and managing the Native community that's there, which is a really tight-knit community, and making them work cohesively, and then bringing them to a place to where now they all know how to become leaders, and seeing a young woman that's very young do that with a bunch of young people, but a lot of even veterans that were already there, people that had already been in the system that long, the school system that long, to take charge and lead them, but bring the forefront of originality or traditions into American academia, into the modern world, and then bringing it to life and showing it. Wonderful, wonderful human being. I love her to death. I respect her so much as a young person to see what she's accomplished. The second person I would say is her mom. Her mom grew up on the reservation, straight out of Navajo country in the Northern Regency, where the Navajo Nation really doesn't take care of that part of the reservation. They just assume the state, Utah State's going to take care of them. And so it's kind of sad because they're more so limited in regards to the federal side receiving, you know, help and things like that, aid. And she grew up doing everything that everybody does on the reservation. She has a long story of all those hard times, what it is to grow up with no water, hauling water, things like that, living the reservation life. What it, not California reservation. These guys try to claim that res name real quick. They live on rancherias and, you know, two, three story houses, you know, straight up, you know, out of lifestyles of the rich and famous type things. Even if it's a three bedroom house, it's a beautiful house, you know. These guys lived where they had to haul water and they put wood into a wood stove, and that's how they kept their house warm and things like that. And they had to go hunting and go chop wood, you know, and prepare for the winter, things like that. And I believe her name is Sydney Ashmore. She's one of my best friends. She's helped me out a lot throughout my life, getting me to certain ceremonies that I needed to take care of, you know, my combat fatigue, or what we call PTSD, things like that. Very, very, very wonderful woman. She has so much to share. I believe she would give a great insight in the totality of what it is to live on the reservation that way.
I love
along with
that.
her daughter Kat Warren. And third person right now that I can think of, there's somebody out there, but I can't think of them right now.
Any, honestly, and the cool part is any other artists or dancers or leaders or just amazing parents or families, right, that have great lineages, just like yourself, just like myself. Those are the types of folks that I'm looking for. Like when you're cooking dinner later, you're gonna be like, oh shit, I should have said so and so, right, or this and that. But that's why I like to kind of put you on the spot so that we just kind of see what flows out naturally. And yeah, like I can't wait. Feel free to put a little list together. I won't not reach out to anybody. You know what I mean? I'll talk to
Definitely. I had
whoever.
already told my niece about
Yeah.
this, and I told her, I'm gonna reach out, I'll let you know, and we'll see if we can get you on there. I believe you have a good story to share
I'd
with
love
young
that.
people. And then bringing, she has a Gen X vibe to her. So yeah, she's gonna bring some of that, even though she's like, 23 years old. She's gonna bring some of that.
Perfect.
So
That
it's
sounds great.
wonderful, to have that little bit of old soul in her that way.
Hey, I like it, but I appreciate you taking the time. Like I said, thank you so much. And it's really important, and I hope that you were give the stamp of approval for what we're trying to create here.
Oh
And this is going to be something where, like I said, it's a fairly new show. This is our first year doing it. So the one thing about me, and I'm not the most talented guy, I'm not the smartest guy, but I am consistent. And that's the one thing that I understand, that every single day is a new day, and that means it's a clean slate, right? So doesn't matter what happened yesterday, doesn't matter what we have on the horizon for tomorrow, what are we going to do today, right? That's my favorite thing, to go out there and try to compete and be the best version of yourself that you can be, and not necessarily compete about the person next to you or the person, behind you. Run your own race, right? That's the important thing. And you try to get a little bit further tomorrow, based on the results and the work that you put in today, right?
Exactly. I was telling stories, not to take up too much time, but I was telling stories on the social distance powwow on Facebook, and I must have told 86 stories, but I always used to end with this, like, every letter, every word, every noise, every sound, every movement, every gesture, every expression has a meaning. When you apply that to every breath of your life, the world outside your door is an undiscovered country. And this is what it is to really get in touch with the world around you, and you'll learn a whole nother language. You learn how to talk to ants, you learn how to talk to birds, you learn how to talk to dogs, you learn how to talk to the grass, the bushes, simply by sitting there and using a different version of listening and absorbing that. And this is what it is, in regards to becoming a storyteller, understanding stories, and the spiritual liaison tech to that, and combining all those together and putting it into an application, saying, this is what I'm doing every day for myself, always trying to get connected.
I love that. I love that. Well, guys, this has been another episode of Smoke Signals. We appreciate you for listening. Catch you on the next episode.